The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name's Andy Boyd. Today, I'm talking with the playwright Aaron Courtney, author of many plays, including A Map of Virtue, Demon Baby, and Anne, Fran, and Marianne, which we're talking about today. Aaron Courtney, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
I'd love to talk a bit about your kind of journey as a playwright. So what was your kind of first experience of theater as a child?
Oh, I love that question. I love asking other people that question. I have a couple, but I'm gonna go with a non-traditional theater moment, which was I grew up in the beach area in Southern California, Hermosa Beach, and my dad started this little volleyball tournament at the beach, I guess around 4th of July, and we would do a parade. The kids would do a parade where we would like put streamers on our bikes and we would like make, you know, flags and like just parade up and down the Strand, and someone would play music. And then, you know, as an adult, I started to do backyard theater with my husband, Scott Atkins, for like 8 years in our backyard in Brooklyn. We would have an all day kind of festival of experimental work and beer and hot dogs. And then I found that picture of the day of the parade we did when we were little kids. And I was like, oh, like that was maybe my first theatrical event, like creating a public art performance that for no reason, like it was a volleyball tournament, but the children were like, we must be involved as well. And we must put streamers on our bicycles and we must wear interesting outfits. So then I will say a second one was seeing an early Sam Shepard play in the 80s, because I grew up in LA area, and an acting teacher of mine was in it. I think it was Curse of the Starving Class, maybe. And anyways, it was just, we were in a tiny little theater and it was so visceral. And I remember there was this moment where the character keeps opening the refrigerator looking for food and all there is cabbages in there. And the futility of like, even though you know there's only cabbages in there, you still keep looking. And so I didn't quite understand that I would become a playwright, but then in college I took a playwriting class, and that's when I was like, oh, that was kind of the beginning of actually becoming a playwright. But I thought there was something just kind of visceral and raw about being in that little theater and being that intimate, the intimacy. So I guess two different, one was like a kind of public joyful performance, and one was like a intimate personal ritual.
I definitely feel like there's some Sam Shepard in your plays. Is that an influence that stayed with you?
You know, as I learned about more theater people, he's definitely stayed with me. He was definitely a primary source. But then as I like started to learn more about other people like Paula Vogel and Adrian Kennedy and sort of more, like queer artists and artists who were, you know, exploring more diverse stories, he became less of an influence. But he certainly has always been an influence around his very adventurous personal spirit and very visual storytelling. So yeah, he has remained.
So you mentioned you took a playwriting class in college, and you also got an MFA from Brooklyn College. Is that right?
That's right.
So what was that experience like?
Well, both were phenomenal experiences, and both those experiences changed my life. So for undergrad, I went to Brown, and I was a painter, and I loved painting, and I was a visual art major there, and I took a playwriting class taught by Donna Di Novelli. She was a graduate student studying with Paula Vogel, who had just started the MFA program there. And I was blown away. The way Donna taught, which was related to how Paula taught, which was about sort of non-literal storytelling, which also goes back to Sam Shepard, like allowing things not to be literal, allowing pop culture to be part of the storytelling, but also sort of ancient Greek storytelling. And so I immediately was drawn to it. And then I got to study with Paula Vogel when I got to the advanced playwriting class. And that was quite transformative. And then I kept trying to be a painter and was, you know, showing in galleries and museums, but one museum. It sounds very fancy if it's more than one, but just one. And
I've never had any of my paintings in any museum, so you're well ahead of me.
Yeah. So I was also mostly trying to be a painter, but also kind of secretly writing plays on the side. And then I started to do it more seriously. And then I was like, oh, I want to do this seriously, but I don't have really great role models who are doing experimental playwriting. And the dramaturgy around experimental playwriting is not as developed, or I was having a hard time finding people who could push me further in my experiments. And so I always admired Mack Wellman's work and his, I didn't really know much about him as a teacher yet, but I knew his work was extremely adventurous and rigorous and risk-taking. And so I applied to study with him, and then that was a game changer because one, he is an incredible teacher, but he also brings very interesting people together. So through Brooklyn College, I met, you know, then I began teaching there, but I met Young Jean Lee and Thomas Bradshaw and Annie Baker. And then later I taught Haruna Lee and Tina Satter and Sybil Kempson. And so it just became, it was a real hotbed and is still a hotbed for innovative theater thinkers who are playful and kind people, as well as being great experimenters.
Yeah, I've really noticed that the people coming out of Brooklyn College is just a kind of an incredible list of, you know, exciting young playwrights. I guess I want to know, like, what's going on in there? Like, I think about the Tom Waits song, "What's He Building in There?" And I just want to know, like, what are you building in there?
That is so great. I love that song, by the way.
It's so good. And it's like 20 seconds and you're like, I think it's a murder machine. And then a minute and you're like, it's definitely a murder machine.
Yes, yes. Or some kind of a bomb, you know, or who knows.
Yeah.
But it's a great song. It is a great, even being inside the room where you're curious about what happens, it is not clear what happens. I was there for 20 years. I just recently got a new job at Northwestern. So now I'm happily teaching at Northwestern. And currently Tina Satter and Anne Washburn are leading the workshop at Brooklyn College. But what happens? Well, when Mac was teaching, it was very, he was a man of few words, but all of them were like these great mysterious kind of cone riddles. Like you're like, he would give me a piece of advice and literally it would take me 2 years before I understood it. And then I would enact it and then great things would happen. So he's a wonderful observer of people's, who people are and the art they are trying to make and the art they are making. And so I feel like one of his gifts and something I've tried to do as a teacher as well is to really observe the person and what they're passionate about and what they care about and what their voice is and what their idiosyncrasies are and what their interests are outside of theater and just continue to encourage and push them to be the most that thing and then to take the greatest risks in the work that are doing that thing.
What are your sort of non-theatrical obsessions?
One is definitely painting and visual art, which is very aligned with, theater. I also love repetition and pattern. I'm obsessed with, you know, looking for patterns in nature and looking for patterns in art and patterns in music and patterns in theater. And then, as you know from this play, neuroscience and mental health are just, great mysteries to me and also things that have to do with superstitions. No, that's not the word. Supernatural, super like ghosts and,
yeah,
you know, elves and fairies. So I guess, and now more recently, I'm very interested in tattooing and tattoos and I'm writing a musical with Max Vernon. And developed with Ellie Heyman called The Tattooed Lady. And I have several tattoos and I love tattoo art. And I have been learning more and more about the history of American tattooing in writing that musical.
One of the things that I think ties a lot of your work together is that it's sort of scary. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're sort of intentionally interested in, or does that kind of just come in through the interest in the supernatural?
I love that question because actually most of the things that are in my work, I was unaware that I was doing it. Like I didn't really realize I was into symmetry until like three plays after I started being compulsive about symmetry. I didn't realize I was writing about mental health until about six plays later. And then the scariness, I really was not conscious that I was writing scary plays, but I will say that like most writers, probably almost all writers and that I know, we have really kind of paranoid imaginations and we imagine sometimes like the scariest thing happening or the worst thing happening. And so for me and a lot of writers, I know when we sit down to write a play that allows the scariest thing to happen, it's very liberating and it takes it outside of our psyche. So I, like as a little kid, I would also just like imagine what would I do if someone broke in the house and I would like imagine where I would hide and I'd had very elaborate plans and I would also be like, I'm sure I'm not going to wake up in the morning. So I just need to kind of like appreciate this moment because probably I'll be killed in the night. So I think those kind of thought processes lead you to become, you know, might lead you to write plays that are scary or films that are scary.
Were you religious at all as a child?
A little bit. My family is Catholic and we did go, I was baptized and confirmed and we went to church. I'm the youngest of four. And I think my parents were a lot more active in the church. But by the time they got to me, it was, we were still going, but they're very liberal minded people. And, you know, obviously it's very complicated to be a Catholic person who has a liberal agenda around identity and, you know, so, and around many, many things. So mm-hmm. They liked the basic gist of it. And I also like the basic gist of it. And I also appreciate the storytelling in Catholicism. I think there's some really good use of story. But I think the reason why the God is present in that Anne, Fran and Marianne play is that it's such an important invisible force in our world. And so one thing that all these topics have in common is like they're invisible. So like neuroscience, to the common person is invisible. Ghosts are invisible. God's invisible. Depression's invisible, or the thing that causes depression. So, I'm interested in how invisible things impact us so profoundly.
I also asked about that because you mentioned being sure you weren't going to survive the night. And I remember for me, the like prayer of if I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. It never would have occurred to me that I might die in the middle of the night if I hadn't been praying that if I die, I'll be taken to heaven.
Okay,
weird idea to teach children.
You're so right. Because even though we did not pray a lot, of course I knew that prayer. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're right. I think that probably planted that seed.
You know, we're making breakthroughs. So could you talk a bit about, more specifically, about the inspiration behind this play, Anne Fran and Marianne?
Yes. I didn't have an idea for a new play yet. And I was, you know, finishing one and was just kind of, sometimes when I'm in that place, I just try to listen more to something that excites me. And I heard on NPR, this journalist talking about the God helmet, which is in the play. And a lot of people think it's not real, but it is actually a real thing. And Dr. Persinger was doing these experiments where, and he had this like janky old like motorcycle helmet and he put on people's heads and then people are still doing this experiment, and it stimulates your front temporal lobe, and you if you are a person who is religious, it is reported that you experience God, or you experience a sort of spiritual feeling. And then people who aren't religious and who are skeptics people who aren't religious sometimes see like trolls and stuff, which is in the play. But then also the person being interviewed, what was interesting to me, was a skeptic of all these things. And when she had the helmet on, she was like, nothing's happening. But it's all tape recorded. And then when she came out of the room, she listened to her recording. And in fact, she was seeing and feeling and hearing, I don't think she was hearing, but seeing and feeling things that she was talking about into the tape recorder. But her skeptical side, when she came out, was like, yeah, nothing happened. I didn't see or feel anything.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's why, without giving away too much, the agnostic, the atheist, the agnostic, which the scientist who really doesn't believe in religion at all and is skeptical of this God helmet, does have a vision of her father, a happy childhood memory that's brought back. And I think, so anyways, that was kind of inspired by this skeptic on the radio who really was sure she had not had any kind of a strange experience in the helmet.
Yeah. I mean, one thought that occurs to me listening to that story is that skepticism can become its own kind of faith, its own belief system, mm-hmm. that is ultimately not, you know, being tested against the external reality as rigorously as maybe it thinks it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's true of all of our belief systems and patterns. We can get real. And that's also what the play is about, too, which is mm-hmm. like, how can you know what your blind spot is if you can't see your blind spot?
Where are you kind of on this spectrum of credulity and skepticism about, you know, the supernatural, whatever that is?
Yes. This is very interesting because I am so into it, but I don't think I've ever seen a ghost, or like people are like, oh, well, you must have seen ghosts, or, I mean, I've had weird feelings. I've gone into like buildings and been like, someone has been murdered here. Not because it looks any certain way. You just feel something. I mean, I've never checked up to see if my belief was correct. So I tend to believe a lot of things. I tend to believe that if we can't know it, if science can't know it yet, how do we know it's not there? Right. I also think that, yeah, and I guess I do believe in kind of like ESP, and I do believe in that, those kind of things. Like, the, I think there's some kind of like cellular connection between people that is somehow transmitted. I don't know how it's transmitted, but yeah, that's where I am on that. Andrew, what about you? Where do you stand on the supernatural?
Oh, I believe in the supernatural, but I'm religious, so I have like my beliefs, you know.
Yeah.
And I have very little. I find because I have like a fairly, you know, a coherent understanding of like what I think is the supernatural reality, I have very little patience for like people talking about astrology or whatever. Like I'm like, that's obviously not true because, you know, why would it be true? It's just the stars. Why would that affect your personality? And also, why would a kind and loving God communicate to us through the stars?
Yes. See, I love astrology. Mm-hmm. I love how people have different kind of modes that help them. But I do think the planet's pull of on the Earth, I think, does impact us. So we'll have to fight about that another time.
Sounds good. there's a scene in the play that I found really compelling, which you describe as a Meisner-like exercise that Anne and Marianne do, but it's actually been kind of prescribed for them by their marriage counselor.
Yep.
Which I think is just like such a great window into the kind of inherent theatricality of therapy. Is that something that is kind of interesting to you?
Oh, I love that. I love the way you phrase that. I was not consciously thinking about that. I was consciously thinking about repetition and sight. Like, how do we know what we know and how do we see what we see? And I do know that in therapy, I personally have not gone to couples therapy, but I have a lot of friends who have, and that there are these exercises, not this particular one, but similar ones where you really do have to do your homework and you have to sit and do a timer and you have to listen to each other. And so I kind of like that. I like that therapy, this is unrelated to what you were just asking, but I like that therapy has homework and that the homework is about listening.
Yeah. Yeah. Those scenes, I mean, you know, the text on the page is just them repeating the same thing over and over again. But you can really imagine that actors would have a great time trying to inflect those with different meaning each time.
Yes. Yes, they do. They do. And also Jose Zayas, who has directed a bunch of the workshops of it, is very attuned to the musicality of it. And he's, you know, it's, that's the other reason this exercise was helpful for the play, is that I think theater is rhythmic and auditory and as well as visual and all the other things it is, but I wanted a way to have a rhythmic musical score almost, and repetition allows you to do that. Now within the repetition there's definitely a meaning in the ways that they're repeating back and forth the language. So yes, I do think that the actors have enjoyed that very much. And actually it's pretty pleasurable to watch two people mirror each other in this kind of loaded way.
Yeah. This play was a commission from Playwrights Horizons, right?
Yes.
Did you have any, I'm always curious in like how people write commissions. Did you have any sense of like wanting to write a Playwrights Horizons-y play?
Oh, wow. That is such a good question. First of all, they were like, write whatever you want, which is great. Mm-hmm. So they were like, I was like, I have this idea. And, you know, I went in and told them, they're like, that sounds great, but we want you to write whatever you want. So that's liberating. But I definitely thought about the physical space, the two physical theaters that are there. I definitely thought about many of the plays. I'm a big fan of Playwrights Horizons. Some of their plays have been, I think, some of the most groundbreaking in the last 10 years, like Booty Candy, A Strange Loop, The Flick. I mean, there's so many more, but Marjorie Prime by Jordan Harrison. So I have many times in that space seen things that I didn't understand. Like seeing things that are where the combination of the narrative and the visual and the tempo was like a spell, like something happened that wasn't, that was bigger than the sum of its parts. And so I don't think I was thinking that when I started this play, but now that it's finished, a goal I have, or a hope I have for this play, is that it does that. We have not done a full production of it yet, so we don't know if it will do what I want it to do, but I want it to be bigger than the sum of its parts. And I feel like most of the groundbreaking work that they've done there at Playwrights Horizons has done that.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of this stuff has that kind of mystic quality to it, where there's like something going on that you can't quite put your finger on.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. So those were probably influencing me more than I realized. I also wanted to write. I was also challenged myself to write a small cast play, not because it was Playwrights Horizons. I just hadn't done it yet. Most of my other plays have around 7 people. And I was like, why 7? Why do I keep writing plays for 7 people? That seems like a limitation I've put on myself, even though I was unconscious. But so I was like, could I write something that traverses a lot of mental and spiritual and intellectual space that is only 3 performers?
You talked about wanting to go to Brooklyn College to kind of find a place that would encourage you to keep experimenting. And definitely experimental playwriting has been, you know, a context for your work for a long time. Do you have any like desire to write a play that gets like 1 million productions all around the country or something?
Oh, yes, I do. And in fact, I also really love and admire mainstream theater, like theater that follows a more recognizable pattern, because that is also then what you put in the recognizable pattern has to be great.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a play called I Will Be Gone, which is also a ghost story, and that is fairly traditional in its structure. And that was at Actors Theatre of Louisville. I don't know why it's not being produced all over the world. But and then actually Tattooed Lady, the musical, I'm co-writing that with Max Vernon, the book, and it is definitely adventurous on a lot of fronts, but it is also, I think, has the possibility to really be popular outside of like a kind of experimental context. And so anyway, so in fact, we are building it for a wide audience, but we're still, all the content and all the vision is fairly cutting edge. Content-wise, but it's not, I don't feel like we're doing anything insanely risky form-wise, if that makes sense. I mean, it's a little bit. Musicals are weird. They're great, but they're weird. Even the ones that are following a traditional American musical form, it's still so weird. So, and right. it's kind of a miracle that any musical works, but when they do work, I think again, kind of a magical thing happens that's bigger than the sum of the parts.
Yeah. A trope of the classic golden age of American musical is the dream ballet, which is kind of a weird thing to put on stage.
Actually, yes. Like musicals, even the most quote unquote mainstream, like Oklahoma or something, they're very weird. They're weird. And actually, if you just read musicals on the page, they should not work. You're like, what? But then when they happen, you know, they're pretty astounding. So yes, I would love to be in all markets. I think what I care about is writing something I care about, that is something I'm curious about. Sometimes it's more experimental in form, and sometimes it's more, I don't know what the right word is, traditional, mainstream. What's a good word for that?
Yeah, I guess mainstream. Yeah, I don't know. I find this really interesting. It seems like there's kind of like a attitude that some more experimental theater people have that is sort of like contemptuous of mainstream theater. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of mainstream theater, especially now, is really good. Like there's stuff on Broadway. I mean, there's nothing on Broadway now, but like there's stuff on Broadway in the past 10 years that is great. And, you know, I hopefully like Strange Loop will go to Broadway. And if it does, that'll be the best thing on Broadway ever. And yeah, like, it's
it's supposed to. So,
yeah.
I know a lot of experimental theater influences the mainstream and or finds itself in the mainstream eventually because maybe the mainstream caught up to it or and this is, you know, for my colleagues and friends, it's happening. But I think 50 years ago, it probably happened 100 years ago. You know what I mean? Like we think it's new that the new stuff is finally getting to Broadway. But, you know, Gertrude Stein was on Broadway with with an opera, you know, and Florian Stedheimer did the sets. It's like, you know, and O'Neill when he was first, you know, O'Neill's a big weirdo too. So, mm-hmm. so I think the weirdos have get there too.
Yeah. Getting back to the play, I think one of the things that I found really sort of squirmy about it is like as a person who has like sincere religious beliefs, the idea that you could like induce a mystical experience with a helmet is sort of uncomfortable to me in a way that sometimes like hearing people describe their experiences of psychedelics can be uncomfortable to me because I'm like, man, you sound a lot like Teresa of Avila right now. And like that's leads to some dangerous questions. Is that something that you were kind of consciously exploring?
Yes. And I want to hear more about your experience in a second because I actually am deeply curious. I love Teresa d'Avila. I love all of the women who had these sort of like amazing spiritual experiences that were in their bodies. And so for me, again, blind spot because I'm not totally religious. For me, I'm like, of course it's in your brain. And of course the brain can stimulate it because it exists. Just like this is me, Aaron Courtney, not the characters in the play, but like, if God exists, then of course he's in the brain. And of course he can be stimulated just the same way we can smell something if you stimulate a part of the brain, or we can hear something. These are all things that are in the world. So for me, it felt very inclusive of deeply religious people. But so it's very helpful for me to hear that, in fact, it was it's off-putting. Will you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just like, I don't know. I mean, I think it partially has to do with like death, that I want to believe that my experience of the world is not finally just biological because that makes me think that when I die, I'll just die, which I don't want to die. I'm very against that idea of dying. I'm not looking forward to that at all. So I feel like if I think of mystical experiences as a sort of breaking through of the spiritual world into the physical, rather than as something that just solely exists as the physical world, then that seems like, okay, so there is definitely something beyond, you know, this mortal world. Whereas if it's just something that happens in your brain for whatever reason, because you're in the 14th century and you're deathly ill and you're Julian of Norwich or whatever, then that seems like, I don't know, maybe it's just a hallucination, but I don't know if maybe just is a weird word in that context.
I see what you're saying because you're right. Then that if it's only chemicals in your body, then that is really upsetting. But we are biological machines that navigate the world, both spiritual and physical and intellectual, through our chemicals. So so I definitely see it the first way you were talking about it, where it is about our chemical brain, neurological brains are processing this spiritual force and presence, and our biological bodies will die. And whatever the spiritual world is, or that our, you know, souls will go to, or our, you know, depending on one's beliefs, is outside the body. So anyways, I just think it's a way of processing it.
Yeah.
Process. It's how our brain processes it, as opposed to our brain inventing it.
Another theme of this play is trauma, and both of the main characters experienced traumatic murders of one of their parents in their childhood. And I feel like trauma has often been kind of latent in your plays, but it seems like it's more explicitly a part of this one. Mm-hmm. What kind of interested you in that theme?
I think two things. Again, back to childhood. When I was growing up, my mom ran a child abuse prevention center, and my dad is a criminal defense attorney. And so dinner topics were often about addiction, violence, incarceration, just kind of as facts that happen to people. I mean, the people are either victims or the perpetrator of the crime. But so same as you were talking about with the prayer before bed, where it's like, if I should die before I wake, it's like their daily life was about meeting people pretty much on one of their worst days in relationship to violence and trauma, and sometimes healing and recovery. I mean, certainly in my mom's work, it was around the recovery, but even as a criminal defense attorney, you are, depending on why the person and how the person committed the crime, there can be a journey of recovery coming out of a kind of a traumatic moment. So I just listened, and I was like, it really went in. And then later my parents were like, why do you write such depressing and dark plays? And I said, hello, what are your jobs? Like, you're both of your tolerance and interest in meeting people in a very dark time is really high. And they were like, oh, they hadn't thought of it.
Wow. Another thing about the play is that the characters all seem to be very concerned with safety and with feeling safe, mm-hmm. As a response to their trauma, and kind of setting up these very elaborate mechanisms of safety. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you sort of saw discussed in your childhood home as well?
Not so much. Also, my family is pretty Irish. And so, sure. So there's a lot of like, it's going to be fine. Just tell a story about it. It's going to be fine. I think it was more my brain chemistry is I have suffered from depression, and I'm on antidepressants, and I'm very open about that because I feel like it's just reality. And I think it's important for people to, if medication helps, to take medication. So since I've been on antidepressants, I'm less fearful, but I spent a lot of my life just very, very afraid of everything. And even very simple things were really scary to me. And so my brain did work to create systems to help me be less afraid. So I think the earlier plays, it was more operated on a kind of loosey-goosey level. And now as I get older, and I also love systems, and, you know, and I love people healing, and I love people, you know, working to make their lives better. So, so now it's a little, this play does definitely have the most, concrete, examples of people really methodically working towards healing. But also, of course, it was written, you know, right after Trump was elected, and, you know, the increase in, not the increase, the awareness of the violence against Black people, you know, institutionalized racism on all levels, but specifically with police violence. And I was like, you know, the whole country felt like, and then now the pandemic, like everybody is like, okay, we are not safe. And we like, you know, and we need to figure out ways to feel safer. And even people who voted for Trump, they weren't feeling safe either. Mm-hmm. So anyways, I'm interested in the ways that people try to feel safe. And sometimes it is positive ways that people work to feel safe. And sometimes it's negative ways.
Yeah. And oftentimes it can be hard to know whether the ways that you're keeping yourself feel safe are positive or negative.
Exactly. That is exactly the question.
One of the other things that is interesting to me about the play is its discussion of kind of scientific ethics, and without spoiling too much, one of the scientists sort of loses sight of the human reality of what they're doing, mm-hmm. Which I think is also something that artists sometimes do. Yes. Is that something that you worry about in your work?
I don't feel I worry about that. I probably should worry about that more. but I definitely is.
But do you feel bad for your characters?
Oh, for my characters or for my collaborators?
Oh, either way. But for me all the time, I'm like, I will often be like, oh man, this character that I really like is sure being a jerk in this scene. Maybe I'll just make him be 10% nicer, which is maybe not like the best way to create compelling drama. But
yes, I never feel really bad for my characters. No, I feel like it's a place where I let people be horrible. And it's very releasing. But I do sometimes worry about the actors who have to play these people and the directors who have to like create the environment for them to play these people, which, I mean, it's not like they're the most heinous people in the world, but there is, you know, violence like in Map of Virtue that is, you know, not fun. And so, so anyways, I guess I worry more about the collaborators than the characters. But then the ethics and science that came up in this play because I showed it to a draft to a bunch of scientists and they gave me really good feedback around specifically scientists who are using human subjects and sort of the ethical dilemmas that happen in that case. So that particular strand in this play came from sharing it with scientists and psychiatrists and realizing how for any scientist or person who's been a subject watching the play, if I didn't address it, it was going to be an incredibly unsafe experience or uninteresting experience because it's such a big part of that world.
What else did the scientists say when you showed them your play?
Oh, they were great. They were great. That was the main thing that they encouraged me to continue to explore. They very kindly, I don't know if they were, they very kindly said I got the science correct, which was, I can't imagine that I actually did, but I guess to the degree that the science is in there, they said I got it right. And then they said, less science, more theater. They said you've explained all the science appropriately and accurately, but we all go to theater for like this human experience and you just cut just a little less exposition basically. And that was a great note.
I love that they felt empowered to give you like an artistic note.
Oh, yes, because this group is called New Write and they're out of Columbia and they are all scientists who write. They are all like neuroscientists and psychiatrists and they're, you know, doctors, but they also write either fiction, nonfiction, you know, creative work, popular science. And so they are specifically a group of scientists who write. So even though none of them are playwrights, they also are fans of theater and they go see theater. And so they had opinions about what they like as audience. So it's good. Very helpful.
How do you get connected with that group?
Oh, so actually, I don't know if you read in the back of the book, the interview in the back is with Jose Zayas, and Carl Eric Fisher is a MD psychiatrist, and he also teaches at Columbia. He writes at Brooklyn Writer's Space, and he is writing a wonderful book about addiction. He specializes in addiction treatment, and he is writing a wonderful book. And he came. Brooklyn Writer Space has a reading series, well, we used to, and we hope to soon again. And he came, and he and his wife, and I read some of Anne, Fran, and Marianne, and he was like, you know, so excited. And he was like, would you like to come be part of our, not be part of our group, but be a guest in our group, and we could read the play, and we could give you feedback. And I was like, 100,000 times yes.
That's fantastic.
So there's a little bit of luck involved with that.
Well, Aaron Courtney, I've already taken up so much of your time, but thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about Anne, Fran, and Marianne.
Thank you so much. And I feel like I was supposed to double back to something with you that I wanted your opinion on. We did talk about the religion in the play.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Okay. So I guess we got
let me know if you have any, if you have anything you want to ask me.
Yeah, I just think it's, as I said before we started talking, recording, I just am really appreciative that you are doing this and that you're bringing, you know, performance people together to talk while we're in, you know, we're coming out of quarantine. I remember now what I wanted to ask you.
Great.
Oh, here's my question for you, Andy Boyd. Why do you want to make your characters likable, and how can you, or whatever, like, you don't want them to do anything horrible, and what are you doing to try to, I mean, you don't have to change that. You certainly, you should write the plays you want to write, but I am curious.
I think part of it is that I think people will think I'm a bad person if my characters are mean to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, so I'm working on one play now where I need one character to like another character after a scene where all the characters have a big fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did a reading of the play and somebody said, I don't think that character would like that character after that character said all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I like people who've said bad things, so
that's,
I don't know.
That's exactly right. We do not always operate in our best interest. So I think sometimes when people give feedback like that, it's okay to ignore it. Because I think we still fall for people who've said bad things or love people who've said bad things. So I encourage you to keep listening to this, you know, the narrative you want to put out there. And it's important to listen to people, but you don't have to actually take their advice. Oh, I have one last thing to say, which is
great.
I'm in a writer's group with Club Thumb writer's group. And this, so even though I say to you, oh, I love making my characters do horrible things, I, for many, many years, hated any characters have a major conflict on stage. So they could do bad things, but they couldn't have a real argument on stage. And so with Anne, Fran, and Marianne, I kept not writing the scene where they really argue after the bad thing that happens, which we won't say what it is. And all the writers in the group were like, Aaron, you have to actually write that argument. You can't just end the play. And they're like, you're ramping up to this argument and you're not writing it. And so it did take me like 6 months to actually write that argument. So even though I'm saying to you, you know, I
but
guess
that
I'm,
seems like
I,
what you're saying. You're saying like, put the conflict in the play. That's part of life, right?
Yes, but I'm just saying I also avoided it for a long time.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's always interesting to me. It's like I always am interested in plays that try to have scenes that aren't built around conflict, because that does seem like so much the default.
Yeah.
I actually, this is like way off topic now, but whatever. When I was in grad school, Sarah Rule came in to talk to us. And I'd heard her on a podcast talking about, she's the best.
Yeah.
I'd heard her on a podcast talking about something that Maria Irene Fornes said to her, which is people think that everybody wants something all the time. That's not true. That's only true of Americans. And I asked her would you like to tell us more about the context of that? And she said, you got the quote wrong. It's Americans and criminals.
Oh, that is not off topic at all. That is a beautiful quote. And I think this is part of why most of my plays, I was avoiding conflict, because I was like, we're not always running around stating what we want and trying desperately to get it. But sometimes we do have to do that sometimes a play requires it. The story requires it. So then you have to do it.
I think that's a great note to end on. Thanks again so much for being on the program, Aaron Courtney.
Thank you. Do you go by Andy or Andrew?
I go by Andy, yeah.
Andy, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. I can't wait to listen to your other podcasts.